the title I was asked to speak to, soil nitrification, versatility, flexibility and diversity. And I first started working on nitrification and nitrifiers about 40 years ago, or 30 years ago, so not as old as I think. And one of the great things about nitrifiers then was that they were, and nitrification was, that it was easy. It was simple. and simple on a number of levels. First of all, there were just two groups of organisms that we had to worry about, ammonia oxidizers and nitrite oxidizers. And here is a typical ammonia oxidizer and a typical nitrite oxidizer. And as I'm sure many of you know, what happens is ammonia goes into an ammonia oxidizer cell and is converted to nitrite, and then the nitrite, some of the nitrite goes, or the nitrite goes out into the soil solution, into a nitrite oxidizing bacteria, and where it's converted to nitrate. The ammonia comes from decomposing organic matter, animal excreta, and of course fertilizer nitrogen, and the nitrate goes into the soil solution where it can be denitrified or it can be leached from the soil, and both of those processes lead to significant economic losses, fertilizer, and also lead to groundwater pollution. Both of these organisms are also autotrophic. They use carbon dioxide as a source of biomass. And that's the textbook view of nitrification. Two groups of bacteria, fairly simple metabolism is how it's portrayed. And as I say, that's pretty much the story of nitrification 30 or 40 years ago. We now know that in terms of the processes that these organisms carry out, it's much more complex than this. So both of them can use organic carbon, particularly nitrite oxidizers, many of which can grow on organic carbon rather than CO2, but also ammonia oxidizers can metabolize organic carbon, including xenobiotics. Ammonia oxidizers can also some of them at least, can use urea. Some of them have urease, and that's particularly important in acid soils because it gives them a mechanism for growing at low pH. Both of them also produce nitrous and nitric oxide. Both of them can denitrify and therefore contribute to global warming. And the enzyme which oxidizes ammonia, ammonium monooxygenase, is multifunctional. It can oxidize organic carbons and it can also oxidize methane. So they can also, some of them at least, can produce methanol. So as you can see, the yellow arrows there are what you find in textbooks. The other colored arrows are the additional processes which these organisms can carry out. And it's those processes, if you like, which give them their versatility and their flexibility. Note also that this process here, the denitrification, if you like, is carried out under anaerobic conditions. So although these organisms were considered aerobic, they can grow at low oxygen concentrations and also under anaerobic conditions. So much more complex than we see in the textbooks in terms of the processes. But what I want to focus on mostly in this talk is the organisms, or the organisms that carry out this process. And as I say, this is a typical ammonia oxidizer, this is a typical nitrite oxidizer. This is nitrous ammonis europaea, which if you like is the lab rat of ammonia oxidizers. It's the ammonia oxidizer about which we know most. And this is Nitrobacter winogradsky, which is a typical nitrite oxidizer. I'll say no more about nitrite oxidizers in this talk. I want to focus on ammonia oxidizers, except to say that both of these organisms were first, organisms of this type were first isolated over 100 years ago. And over the intervening 100 years, physiological studies, biochemical studies have been carried out on them. The genomes of both of these organisms this one has been sequenced. This one is being sequenced, and other ammonia and nitrite oxidizers are being sequenced. We know a lot about these organisms, but they're not very easy to grow. They're difficult to isolate, they're difficult to maintain in the lab. Nevertheless, we know a lot about them. They were classified originally. The nitrite oxidizers were placed in four genera, and they are still in four genera. But as I say, I won't say any more about them. I'll focus on the ammonia oxidizers. And they were classified originally on the basis of their the main factor used to classify them was, main character was their shape. So this is Nitrous ammonis, Nitrous aspira, Nitrous alobus, Nitrous vibrio. You can see the different cell morphologies, and then Nitrous acoccus. Again, five genera. We now know, because when people started using molecular methods, started using 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequencing to classify bacteria, they found that these four genera belong to the beta proteobacteria, and this organism here, Nitrous acoccus, belongs to the gamma proteobacteria. At this meeting, we don't have to worry about Nitrous acoccus because it's only been found in marine environments, but these four genera are the major soil ammonia oxidizing bacteria. And in fact, the 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequencing placed these three genera into a single one, which is now called Nitrous aspira. Now, the use of 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequencing revolutionized microbial taxonomy, and I'll give another example of that later. But it also, eventually, revolutionized microbial ecology, because it enabled us, using primers, which were specific, primers based on 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences that were specific for particular groups of organisms, it enabled us to amplify DNA from the amplify those genes from environmental DNA and study these organisms without cultivation, without the need for laboratory growth. So the basis of this approach is illustrated here. Take our soil sample, lyse the cells within the soil, extract nucleic acids, purify those nucleic acids, and then amplify by PCR or RT-PCR, either 16S ribosomal RNA genes or, for ammonia oxidizers, MOA genes. Now, 16S ribosomal RNA genes have been used to look at community structure of all bacteria. MOA genes encode ammonia monooxygenase, which is a key functional gene for ammonia oxidizing bacteria. So we have two tools here with which we can study ammonia oxidizers: 16S ribosomal RNA genes and MOA genes, and that will become critical as in the later part of my talk. So we amplify up gene fragments and end up with a population, if you like, of bits of DNA, all of the same length, and we treat that population, we use that population to determine, to characterize the community from which it arose. And we do that by sequencing these bits of DNA and comparing those sequences to sequences which are in databases to get identification and to do phylogenetic analysis of our ammonia oxidizers, or we can use fingerprinting techniques to do more rapid analysis of changes in the community structure. And what these techniques demonstrated when we first started using them is illustrated in this slide. So what I'm going to show here is a phylogenetic tree which contains sequences from pure cultures of ammonia oxidizers, sequences from soil, from the oceans, and from sewage. And first of all, Nitrous aspira, they are the pure culture sequences we had at the time. There's some soil sequences, marine sequences, and so on, and the same for Nitrous ammonis. And the first thing that you can see is that there is enormous diversity there. Okay, no two sequences are the same, and this is typical. When we analyze natural communities of ammonia oxidizers, we find incredible diversity. We found we could group these sequences into a number of clusters, four for Nitrous aspira, three for Nitrous ammonis, but the classification of Nitrous ammonis has been carried out much more rigorously now, using full-length sequences rather than partial sequences, which is what this tree is based on. But you can see that the soil sequences tend to fall into cluster 2, cluster 3, and cluster 4, and some of these clusters here. You can also see that some of the clusters, for example this one, do not contain any pure culture sequences, even to this day. So these are clusters with no known cultivated representative with which we can study physiology and biochemistry and predict ecology. So that remains to this day. There are two clusters, 5 and 1, which have no cultivated sequence, cultivated organisms. And down here we have Nitrous ammonis europaea, our lab rat, which we have treated, or we did treat in those days, as a typical soil ammonia oxidizer. But you can see that the sequences most closely related to it are, there's one soil sequence here, but these are marine sequences, and the majority of soil sequences are Nitrous aspira sequences. So this illustrates not just, this slide illustrates, not just the enormous diversity of ammonia oxidizers, but also the fact that cultivation-based techniques do not necessarily select for organisms which are representative of the natural community. So this was, if you like, the first molecular revolution in ammonia oxidation in nitrifying bacteria, because it revised our thinking of ammonia oxidizers. It allowed us for the first time to study the ecology and community structure and diversity of these organisms, and we thought, great, this is it, we've cracked it. And we then did, and many other groups did, studies to look at the ecology of these organisms. And I'll just give you two, well, I'll give you one example now and another later of how we did this. So one of the things we were interested in was whether sheep urine in grassland soils altered the community structure of ammonia oxidizers, and whether the heterogeneity in ammonia concentrations introduced by sheep urination, patchiness if you like, how that affected nitrification rates and nitrifier communities. And what we found was that there was heterogeneity in the particular ecosystem we were looking at in nitrification rates. So sometimes we would have a big lag before nitrification when we added ammonia, sometimes nitrification occurred immediately. And we wanted to know if that was due to differences in the community structure. So we did a microcosm study where we added either distilled water as a control or synthetic sheep urine containing 1 milligram of nitrogen per gram of soil, which is what you typically get in the soil after a sheep urination event. And we sampled and during incubation and measured pH, ammonia nitrate, urea, and we used one of these fingerprinting techniques, DGGE, to look at the changes in the community structure. And just to give you two quick examples of what we've found, here is one microcosm, here's our control where nothing much happens, and here's our treatment where we've added urea, and you can see that you get nitrate produced in this case after a lag of about 25 days, maybe 30 days. So in this case, this is an example of a soil sample which gave us a big lag. What happens to the community structure here? Well, this community was dominated by three groups of ammonia oxidizer. Nitrosammonas, which you can't really see in any of these banding patterns here, but these two clusters, cluster 3A and 3B, which are subdivisions of cluster 3 I showed you on the earlier slide. And you can see that at time zero, we have a band on the gel for cluster 3A and nothing for cluster 3B. So this community is dominated by cluster 3A initially. And then as time goes on, you can see a band for cluster 3B appearing, which eventually, if you like, outcompetes the cluster 3A band, so that eventually you have only the community dominated by cluster 3B. Here's a second example where we have the other extreme, if you like. Here, we get, when we add our urea, we get nitrification occurring rapidly. So here you see nitrate being produced after just a couple of days, and in this community, we have dominance right from the beginning by cluster 3B. Okay, so and we did this many times, and certainly in the unfertilized grassland soils that we were looking at, in every case, we had a lag in nitrification when the community was dominated initially by cluster 3A, no lag if it was dominated by cluster 3B. We then wondered why this might be, and we knew that some ammonia oxidizing bacteria can be inhibited by high ammonia concentrations. So we took a typical cluster 3B organism, one we had in culture, and looked at the effect of ammonia concentration. And it grew at 1, 10, 100, and 1,000 parts per million ammonia. It wasn't inhibited by high ammonia. Whereas our cluster 3A pure culture grew at 1, 10, 100 parts per million, but not at 1,000 parts per million. So it was inhibited. And then we took some enrichment cultures from the grassland soils that we were studying. Here's a cluster 3B enrichment, which you can see is not inhibited. Here's a cluster 3A enrichment, which was inhibited. So in this case, we could draw a direct link between ecosystem function, whether we got a lag in nitrification or not, community structure, whether we had dominance by cluster 3B or cluster 3A, and the physiology or the physiological diversity of those of the ammonia oxidizers, whether they were inhibited by high ammonia or not. So this is one example, at least, where community structure does matter for rates of nitrification, and therefore for plant nutrition, because if the nitrification occurs straight away, the nitrate will be lost from the soil and plants will suffer. And so that was one example. This is just another slide which I love showing, not because I have any credit for it, but Shahid Mahmood worked in my lab and was excellent at doing DGG gels. And this is just gives you an idea of how you can follow changes in community structure using these techniques. And what he did was to repeat that microcosm experiment, but using three different levels of nitrogen. So here we have three replicates at each of these nitrogen levels under control. Here we have markers for the different clusters of ammonia oxidizer. So each of these bands represents a different phylotype, a different ammonia oxidizer type. This is at day two. When I click on the mouse, what you will see are changes in the banding patterns in these three areas as time goes on, and changes with nitrogen concentration. So here, that was day two. Here's day seven, day 14, day 28, day 42, and there's one more, which is day 56. Okay, so these are very powerful techniques. They allow us to follow the community structure of ammonia oxidizers and other bacteria, of course, in the soil without growing them. We couldn't possibly do this sort of experiment if we depended on cultivation of ammonia oxidizers. And as I say, many other groups were doing these experiments and thinking we were getting nitrification sorted, and we were really getting to know about the ecology of nitrifying bacteria. And then a sort of bombshell hit, really. There was another revolution. And before describing exactly what that revolution was, I want to say something about the Crenarchaeota. Here's the tree of life, again based on the 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences, 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences. And one of the ways in which that revolutionized bacterial taxonomy was to show that we had eukaryotes, which we already knew about, but the bacteria, which we thought were a single group, were actually two separate kingdoms, the bacteria and the archaea, which were as different in evolutionary terms from each other as they were from, as each of them were from, was from eukaryotes. And in fact, archaea are more closely related to eukaryotes than bacteria. Archaea, when this reclassification was done, were considered to be extremophiles. They liked high temperatures, high salt concentrations, extreme anaerobic conditions, and so on. Because the organisms, the archaea that have been cultivated, were extremophiles. But you can see one group here, Crenarchaeota. Here's another drawing of the Crenarchaeota tree. Again, most of these are extremophiles, but here you have group one, Crenarchaeota. Now, they were discovered, if you like, with the advent of molecular techniques. People went out, did 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequence analysis of non-extreme environments, soil, oceans, and they found group 1 Crenarchaea. Completely unexpected, not only were they there, they were abundant. In marine environments, these group 1 Crenarchaea are 20% of all prokaryotes. So 20% of bacteria plus archaea are these group 1 Crenarchaeotes. In the soil, the proportions are less, but still significant. 2, 3, 4%. So if you go out to any soil, go to your soil in your back garden, you will find abundant Crenarchaea, group 1. But we only knew about them through the fact that we could detect their 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences, and we didn't know what they did. And then, this slide just illustrates the phylogeny of 16S ribosomal RNA gene. Phylogeny of Crenarchaea. Here we have the cultured organisms, the extremophiles. Then we have the remainder of this tree comes from sequence data only, environmental sequence data only, and not from cultivation-based studies. So we have marine organisms, sediment organisms, more sediments and fresh water sequences, more marine sequences, and then as we get to this part of the tree, we get more soil. So here's some sequences which are found in forest soils, some more from marine environments. These are These sequences are found in most soils and in other environments, some more marine water and sediment sequences, and then some more soil sequences which seem to be root associated. So this was the phylogeny of the Crenarchaea, but 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences don't tell you much about function unless you're very lucky. And then came the bombshell. And before describing the bombshell, just a bit about the structure of this ammonia monooxygenase gene. Okay, keep the tension going. So the ammonia monooxygenase gene has three subunits, MOA, MOB, and MOC, and is very similar to the methane monooxygenase gene, which also has three subunits, A, B, and C. In nitrous aspira, typical ammonia oxidizer, they're arranged like that, similarly in a typical methylotroph, methylococcus. Okay. And both of those groups are in the proteobacterium. The bombshell was that two groups, Christa Schlieper's group, she was then in Germany, and Craig Venter, sequencing the oceans, discovered on large pieces of DNA that they were analysing, they discovered on the same piece of DNA that had a 16S crenarchaeal ribosomal RNA gene, they discovered an ammonia monooxygenase gene homologue, a gene that was similar in sequence, quite different, but similar in sequence to ammonia monooxygenase. Okay, so this is the soil genomic fragment that Christa found, and this is the Sargasso seed fragment. So they have not just they have two subunits for this fragment, all three subunits in this fragment. Okay, now that set the world alight because it suggested, but only suggested, that Crenarchaea may be ammonia oxidizers. It suggested that they had possibly the potential to be ammonia oxidizers. And in fact, what happened was some people looked at this and said, "Oh, amazing, we've been working on the wrong bacteria, wrong organisms all our lives. We shouldn't be working with bacteria, we should be working on archaea." Other people said, "We don't believe it. Just because this MOA gene homologue is there doesn't mean it's the organisms can oxidize ammonia," which is true. The ammonia monooxygenase in bacteria is multifunctional. It can do lots of things. Maybe it's doing something else in archaea. The gene sequences are actually quite different, so maybe it has a completely different function. So, if you like, there were two camps, and there were some people in the middle as well. But certainly some people went into denial about archaeal ammonia oxidizers. And fair enough, because this was only very circumstantial evidence. Oh, there's another soil genomic fragment. So all of those in Crenarchaea. But we can see where this fits in our tree. Here's our tree again for the Crenarchaea. And the soil genome fragment is here. It's in this group down here. So the 16S sequence associated with that MOA gene falls in this group here. Now, you can argue about circumstantial evidence and so on. You can say, well, the gene might be doing something else and so on. But when you then get a culture of the organism which can oxidize ammonia, then you have to start worrying about archaeal ammonia oxidation. And Martin Conacher in Dave Stahl's lab had already actually isolated Nitrosa pumilus maritimus, the first mesophilic crenarchaean, before this metagenome sequence was published. And they found that it was an autotrophic ammonia oxidizer. This is what it looks like, and this is how it grows. Here we have ammonia decreasing, nitrite increasing, cell number increasing. This is growing. This organism is growing in medium, which is just mineral salts plus ammonia. It grows at round about the same rate as normal ammonia oxidizers, not Nitrosomonas europaea, the lab rat, which grows faster than any of them, but it grows at similar sorts of rates to other ammonia oxidizing bacteria. And it grows autotrophically. And we know a bit about the physiology. We'll know a lot more in the near future because they're now sequencing the genome, or they have sequenced it, and I'm sure that information will be published in the near future. So, now we have a culture that can a crenarchaeal, mesophilic crenarchaea, that can oxidize ammonia, which is more than circumstantial evidence that the crenarchaea can be ammonia oxidizers. And the sequence for that, so here's the MOA gene structure, the ammonia monooxygenase gene structure, and here's where the sequence, the 16S sequence, falls within our phylogenetic tree. So we have one here, and we have one here. Now I'm afraid I'm going to have to move out of soil for a bit, because, well, in fact, the pure culture was a marine aquarium isolated. It wasn't isolated from soil, and we still don't have an isolated of these organisms from soil. But Ed DeLong's group were studying this sponge, Axinella, because it is packed full of a particular Crenarchaeum, Crenarchaeum symbiosum, and it's the only archaeon in this in the sponge, and 5% of the sponge RNA is archaeal RNA. And what that means is that they could construct a genome from phosmid DNA. They could reconstruct the genome of this organism, and what they found were AMOA, AMOB, and AMOC gene homologs. So the bacteria that were packing this sponge appeared to be able to have the potential, at least, to oxidize ammonia. And their sequences, the 16S sequences, fall here. Now, what they could do then was to look for homologs from this reconstructed genome. They could look at those gene homologs to try and find out what the Crenarchaea might do. Because if you just have 16S data, you don't know anything about function. But if you have a whole genome, then you can start to predict function. And what they found was that it had the genes for the 3-hydroxypropionate cycle for CO2 fixation, but it also had the complete TCA cycle. So potentially, it could grow as a heterotroph, as well as an autotroph. But more interestingly, what about nitrogen cycling genes? Well, here's part of the nitrogen cycle. Here's urea going to ammonia, going down here to nitrite, nitrate, and then denitrification here, nitric, nitrous oxide, and nitrogen. The red rectangles here are where they indicate where they found a gene homolog. The green ones are where they found a gene homolog. The red ones are where they couldn't find an enzyme corresponding to a particular step in the pathway. So they found ammonia monooxygenase, we already know that. They didn't find hydroxylamine oxidoreductase. Ammonia is oxidized to hydroxylamine, which is then reduced to nitrite. They couldn't find that. But they found other genes with potential function which might be carrying out that process. They found an ammonia permease, and they found urease, which suggests the organism could grow on urea, and they also found a urea transporter homolog. And they found a nitrite reductase and a nitric oxide reductase gene homolog. So potentially, the organism could carry out part of the denitrification pathway as well. Again, this is all circumstantial evidence. It's just gene homologs are there. Doesn't necessarily mean the organism is carrying out these functions, but it means it might be able to. This organism falls. Oh, sorry. Crenarchaeum symbiosum is here, but Ed DeLong's group also think they have evidence for this group being ammonia oxidizers as well. I don't have time to go into that evidence. But you can see that what we now have is evidence that all of the organisms in this part of the tree, to the right of the red arrow, potentially can oxidize ammonia. Right. Now, we can also now create a phylogeny based on the ammonia monooxygenase genes. So here are the bacterial AMOA genes and also the equivalent genes in methane oxidizers. And down here, some distance away, in terms of evolutionary distance, are the archaeal AMOA genes. Okay. And when you have start to accumulate data like this, what you can do is, as with the bacteria, create a second tool to look at the archaea. So now we have, as with the bacteria, we have two genes with which we can look at their ecology. 16S ribosomal RNA genes and AMOA genes. For the 16S ribosomal RNA genes, for the Crenarchaea, we don't know that every Crenarchaean in a particular group can oxidize ammonia. We know some representatives of particular 16S groups can, but we don't know for certain that all of them can. But obviously, when we're using the AMOA gene to look at these Crenarchaea, then we can at least say they have the potential to oxidize ammonia. So we have a 16S gene, 16S genes and primers, and AMOA genes and primers with which we can study alkyl ammonia oxidizers, and with which we could distinguish them from bacterial ammonia oxidizers, because you can see that the MOA gene in bacteria is very different to the MOA gene in archaea. And of course, people then did that. They went out and looked for MOA genes, and they found them. They found archaeal MOA genes pretty much wherever they looked. And there were, I won't go into these. This tree, you'll be pleased to know. But this is a paper published by Chris Francis in PNAS a couple of years ago, which was a survey of MOA genes that in databases and ones which he'd looked for. And here we have a group of sediment sequences, here water column sequences, and here soil sequences. So they're pretty much ubiquitous. If you look for MOA genes, you'll find them, probably. I don't know anyone who hasn't. And you might actually find them easier to find. They might actually be easier to find than bacterial MOA genes. More of that in a minute. Okay, so these organisms have MOA genes. They are abundant. So what? Are they more abundant than bacteria? Well, the way we can look at that is by quantifying MOA genes of bacteria, quantifying MOA genes of archaea. And this is a paper by Sven Leininger et al., in which we were involved. Sven is in Christa's lab, Christa Schlieper's lab. And what he did was to compare, to quantify bacterial and archaeal MOA genes in a number of soils. Here we have the soils that they used. Pristine soils, agricultural soils, and here we have numbers of copies of the MOA gene per gram of soil. And note this is on a logarithmic scale. Okay, and we're looking at the MOA gene from archaea, which is in sort of orangey brown, and the MOA gene from bacteria, which is in blue, for each of these soils. And you can see that in each case, the archaeal MOA gene was more abundant than the bacterial MOA gene. In every case, and remember it's a log scale, and if you look at the ratios of the two genes, sometimes it's, you know, probably within experimental error, 1.5, 2.5, sometimes it's not. 232-fold, two orders of magnitude more abundant in that case. Now this again was a bit of a bombshell, because it suggested that we knew how abundant Kren archaea were, and we knew how abundant ammonia oxidizing bacteria were, but this said that the archaeal ammonia oxidizers might be more abundant in soil than the bacterial ammonia oxidizers, and therefore might be more important. But this just tells us about abundance. It doesn't tell you about activity. This is just gene copies. It's not activity. And there's a long way to go between having a gene in your chromosome and carrying out an ecosystem process. That gene has got to be transcribed into messenger. It's got to be converted, translated into protein. The protein has to have the right cell condition, the right physiological conditions in the cell to be active, and so on. So there's a long way to go from having a gene to carrying out global biogeochemical cycling processes. Now, we had already been studying Kren archaea without knowing that they were ammonia oxidizers. And a postdoc in my lab, Graham Nickel, who's responsible for most of the Kren archaeal work most of our Kren archaea work I'll be talking about, had been studying Kren archaea in this wonderful site in the Austrian Alps, which actually made me do field work. I visited this site last year, and it's great, can recommend it. And it's the receding glacier. So this is where the glacier was in 1865, and you can see the dates and how fast it's moving back up the mountain here. Here it is today. And what we were looking at was, we were using 16S based techniques to look at Kren archaeal communities as soil developed after it was exposed when the glacier receded. So here you have fairly mature soil, and then round here you have just glacial material and rocks and so on, as you'll see on this slide. So here's material that's been exposed for 48 years, 75 years, and then for a long time. And when we used 16S ribosomal RNA genes to follow the Kren archaeal community, we tended to see this transition. So as the soil matured, and incidentally, as the pH increased, we saw a change in the Kren archaeal community. But this didn't tell us anything about what they might be doing. We just saw these changes. When this bombshell broke, we went back to these same samples and looked for AMOA genes to see if the archaeal AMOA, potential archaeal ammonia oxidizers, were also changing in community structure. And we found the same. Okay, so this is the archaeal AMOA gene, and you can see the banding patterns change as the soil matures. But again, this only tells us about potential ammonia oxidation. It tells us that the archaeal communities are changing. It doesn't tell us that they are oxidizing ammonia. Now, another thing that we've been interested in over the years, as mentioned earlier, is the influence of pH on ammonia oxidizers. Because as pH decreases, ammonia is ionized, it's more difficult to get into the cell, and nitrification slows down. And in fact, cultivated ammonia oxidizing bacteria can't really grow below pH 7, but you get nitrification in acid soils. And this is a great site that we have just outside Aberdeen, where soil has been maintained in plots ranging from 4.5 to 7.5 at 0.5 pH unit intervals for 30 or 40 years now. And we'd studied these sites in 10 years ago, when we first got the 16S techniques to look at the ammonia oxidizing bacteria, to see if the different soil pHs selected for different ammonia oxidizing bacteria. And what we found was that the major groups in this soil were clusters 2, 3, 4, and 6A, and that they did, two of them did change significantly with pH. So this cluster 2 phyllotype decreased in relative abundance as pH increased. Cluster 3 increased in relative abundance. Cluster 4 maybe peaked in the middle there. Cluster 6A didn't really do much. But this suggested at the time that there might be selection for different groups of ammonia oxidizing bacteria with pH, and that these might be adapted in some way. But what Graham did was to go back to the same sites, and rather than look for the bacterial, well, he did look for the bacterial ammonia oxidizers to see if John Stephen had got it right, or at least to see if the communities were stable over time. And he found that they were, in fact. So here's our ammonia oxidizing bacterial 16S ribosomal RNA genes. Here's pH going from neutral down to acid. And you can see that some of these the bands change in relative abundance with pH. So this band here is present only in the acid soils. This one disappears in the acid soils and is present only in the alkaline soil. Same for this one, which is present just at the top two or top three pHs. This one again decreases and disappears in the acid soil. This one appears in the acid soil. This one disappears in the acid soil. So the same results as John got, and the sequence types correspond to the sequence types that were changing in John's work. Then he looked at crenarchaeal 16S ribosomal RNA genes, and again found significant differences. So this band and this band are present only in the alkaline or the alkaline to neutral sites. This band are present only in the low pH in the acid soil, in the acid sites. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we don't know that all crenarchaea are ammonia oxidizers. So this may be nothing to do with ammonia oxidation. So we also looked at the ammonia monooxygenase genes, the AMOA genes, and again found the same thing. These bands here disappeared in the acid soils. These peaked at the intermediate pHs. This was present only in acid soils. This one increased in the acid soils. So this suggests that crenarchaea, the crenarchaeal ammonia oxidizers, are adapted in some way to different soil pH values. And these bands corresponded, the band positions, and whether they were present in acid or neutral soils, corresponded to what we found in the glacier. So the low pH sites had low pH sequences, if you like. High pH or neutral pH sites had neutral pH sequences. Again, the presence of a gene tells you only about potential activity, not actual activity. So what Graham then did in these soils was to look not just at the abundance of the genes, but abundance of the gene transcripts in the messenger RNA. So to what extent were the AMOA genes of the bacteria and the archaea being transcribed? So looking at transcriptional activity. So here we have archaeal DNA. This tells us how many archaeal amyloid genes there are at the different pHs. And you can see there is actually a slight decrease as the pH increases. It's a significant decrease. And then here's the messenger. Sorry, that's not the messenger. This is the bacterial gene. So the bacterial amyloid genes don't really change much with pH. Then if we look at the messenger, if we look at transcriptional activity, here we have it for the archaea. And you see, as with the abundance, of the gene abundance, the transcript abundance also decreases as pH increases. And here we have it for the bacteria. This is transcriptional activity of the bacteria, which maybe increases a bit. So we have these trends, but also notice that in all cases, for both the gene abundance and transcript abundance, the archaea are more abundant than the bacteria. So these values are much higher than these, that's the genes, and the transcripts are much more abundant. The archaeal transcripts are much more abundant than the bacterial transcripts. Interestingly, we also plotted the number of archaeal or bacterial amyloid gene transcripts per gene. So the number of transcripts per gene. And this is quite interesting. We're not quite sure what it means. But we find that for the archaea, there's a significant decrease in the number of transcripts per gene with increasing pH. And for the bacteria, the opposite. There's not such a big change, but there's an increase there with increasing pH. So whether this means that the archaea are more important in acid soils or not, we don't know, but that's something we certainly want to look at. The other thing Graham did was to look at short-term activity. So that's telling us about long-term selection. He also looked at short-term activity, looked at transcript abundance in these two extreme pH soils, 4.5 and 7. Here's the community that we get in 4.5. Here's the archaeal amyloid community we get in pH 7 soil. What he did was to mix them. So he mixed the soils and then adjusted the pH of the mixed soils to either 7.5 or to 4.5. Here's nitrification and ammonia consumption in the native original pH 7.5 soil. In the mixed soil, it's slower, as if maybe the neutral pH adapted organisms are being diluted out. Here we have the mixed soil that's been adjusted to 4.5. And here we have the original native 4.5 soil. And again, the mixed soil nitrifies slower. And then he looked at the transcripts. And I've got data here for 2 days, after 4 days incubation and after 12 days incubation. And what we're looking for here is to see whether the 7.5 community, if you like, the 7.5 transcripts and the 4.5 transcripts dominate in, or at least differ in, the 4.5 and 7.5 mixed soils. So if you mix pH 7.5 soil and pH 4.5 soil and then put the soil back to pH 7.5, do you get the organisms that are dominant in the 7.5 soil active, and similarly in the 4.5 mixture, do you get the 4.5 organisms most active? And there's evidence that we do. So here we have a sequence that is just in the 7.5 soil. You can see it's active in the mixed 7.5 soil, but not active in the mixed 4.5 soil. Here we have this a qualitative, well, not such a marked difference, but nevertheless a greater difference, a greater relative abundance in 7.5 than 4.5 for this sequence. And then these are two sequences which are dominant in the 4.5 soil, which show greater transcription in the, or relative abundance in the transcripts in the 4.5 mixtures. So all of this suggests then that bacteria and archaea are selected for, different phenotypes are selected for by different pHs, and it also suggests that the archaea may be important, particularly important in the acid soils. Then finally, Graham also looked at the phylogeny of these two genes that we use, these two tools, 16S ribosomal RNA gene and the AMOA gene within the archaea. So here we have two trees, one for the 16S ribosomal RNA gene sequences, one for the AMOA sequences. And these are sequences that were already in the database before we did this study. And they can be, these are ones that are found in soil. These are 16S sequences, also found in soil. This is 1.1C, 1.1B, 1.1a and 1.1a marine sequences. And then here we have the phylogeny for the MOA genes, again grouped according to the environments from which the sequences were obtained. Now, what happens if we put in the sequences that we got from the acid and the neutral soils? Well, there's the pH 7.5 sequences, and there's the pH 4.5 sequences. And again, you can see it suggests that particular phylotypes are selected for by the low or the high pH. So this phylotype is pH 7.5 sequences and occurs in both trees. Second group here, mainly acid. Third group, mainly 7.5 sequences. Fourth group, mainly acid sequences. Five, mainly acid. And six, mainly 7.5 sequences. So we're suggesting that these two trees are congruent, if you like, that we're getting that these groups correspond to these groups. We don't know that that's definitely the case until we isolate organisms from these groups or do more complex, more detailed genomic analyses of the environments. Nevertheless, it suggests evolution of archaeal ammonia oxidizers to adapt to these two pHs. And then finally, an experiment we did where we looked at the response of ammonia, bacterial and archaeal ammonia oxidizers to temperature. And we set up soil microcosms at a number of temperatures, 10, 15, 20, 25, and 30. And here you see the nitrification rates. This is nitrite plus nitrate production at the different temperatures. And initially we used 16S ribosomal RNA genes to follow the changes in the ammonia oxidizing bacterial community and found very little in the way of change. So you'll see that these histograms represent the relative abundance of different groups of ammonia oxidizing bacteria, and there are some small changes but nothing that's statistically significant with time. This is after 40 days when we've got active nitrification, and with not much difference with temperature. Then we looked at crenarchaeal 16S ribosomal RNA genes, 10, 20, 15, 20, 25, and 30. And here we did see changes. You can see this phylotype increases in relative abundance, so does this one. This one decreases, this one decreases, and some of them disappear altogether. Now, we wanted to compare these two communities in terms of MOA genes. And in terms of MOA gene transcripts. But we couldn't actually get the bacterial MOA gene out of this soil. Now, whether that might mean it's less abundant, the bacteria are less active, we're not sure. But we could look at the archaeal MOA gene and archaeal MOA gene expression. And what we found, again, was that the archaea were much more responsive to the temperature than the bacteria. So this is at 10 degrees, and here we're looking at transcription over time. Not much difference there, but possibly this one appearing at the high temperature as time progresses. Same here. But then certainly at 25 and 30 degrees, you can see significant changes with time in the relative abundance of these different phylotypes. So the bacterial community doesn't seem to respond much, even though there's active nitrification. But the archaeal MOA gene, and therefore presumably the archaeal ammonia oxidizer community, does. And this is most obviously seen in this slide, where we're plotting the ratio of archaeal to bacterial gene transcripts. And you can see at 2 days initially, this ratio is round about one. There are roughly the same number of bacterial and archaeal gene transcripts. But after 40 days, the archaea are much more abundant, particularly at these two higher temperatures. So, what all this indicates, and we can say no more than indicates, is that archaeal ammonia oxidizers may be very important in soil nitrification. A lot of the evidence is indirect. A lot of it the majority of the evidence is molecular. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a big difference between having a gene and carrying out an ecosystem function that's encoded by that gene. The bacteria and archaea are different kingdoms. They have very different biologies, different cell structure, and it may well be that it's easier to get the archaeal genes out, that the transcripts are more stable, and so on and so forth. But when we first started submitting papers and getting comments from referees, and not just us, other people who were working on the Krenak-Hale ammonia oxidizers. One of the comments we got, in fact, one of my colleagues got phoned up by somebody who was in denial about the archaea. It was phoned up and said, "You are ruining my career. I can't get funding to work on bacteria anymore. Stop saying that archaea are the important ammonia oxidizers and give me conclusive proof that archaea are oxidizing ammonia in the soil." And I said, "Well, what did you say?" And well, there's all this stuff about abundance and all this sort of thing. I said, "Well, if there is a pure culture of an ammonia oxidizer that's a Krenak-Hale, that shows that they can do it. That's not circumstantial evidence. They can oxidize ammonia. If that's the case, and all we have is, if the only way we can distinguish between ammonia oxidizing archaea and ammonia oxidizing bacteria is using molecular techniques, then what we have to do is not just prove that archaea are oxidizing ammonia in the soil, we also have to prove that bacteria are important ammonia oxidizers. So this is why I call this a revolution, a bombshell. I and many other people have been working on bacterial ammonia oxidizers for many years, thinking that we were looking at the important organisms in nitrification, and we may have been, we may still be, but we now have to prove that, or prove that the archaea are more important, or find out when archaea are more important for nitrification than bacteria, and when bacteria are more important than archaea. And, of course, we also have to consider the fact there may be other ammonia oxidizers out there that we still haven't discovered. Thank you very much. There was, and there may be, but we haven't discovered it yet. So the limited information that we have on the physiology of the one pure culture that's available, the marine isolate, is that it's inhibited by the same inhibitors. So the traditional nitrification inhibitors inhibit it. There's a possibility that acetylene may give more inhibition of one group than the other, but not enough for proper discrimination. Nevertheless, archaea are very different to bacteria. They have different cell wall structure. There are antibiotics which work against archaea, which are active against archaea and not bacteria, vice versa. And I know people have been looking at those, but with no success yet, partly because, you know, using antibiotics in the soil is not that, you know, they get broken down quickly. So as yet, nobody has come up with a differential inhibitor. But once the other problem is, as well, that we, again, will be depending on molecular evidence to find out whether they were differentially inhibiting, because at the moment we have no pure we have no cultures of soil Krenak-Hale ammonia oxidizers, so that's another problem. But the answer is, as yet, there's no known differential inhibitors. Sure. Yeah. Well, the world is rife with rumour. We've been trying to isolate Krenak-Hale before we knew they were ammonia oxidizers. And what tends to happen is that you get a culture, an enrichment culture, which gives a signal that gives you can amplify 16S gene, and now we can amplify the HAMOA gene. But it'll just disappear for no apparent reason. So that. The other problem is they take 2 or 3 months to grow, so you know this isn't ideal for a PhD project. The story is that it seems to be easier to get marine enrichments, but they are very temperamental, they're very sensitive, as are bacterial ammonia. Anyway, bacterial ammonia oxidizers aren't that easy, but they seem to be as bad and worse. So they seem to just die out after you've cultured them a few times, subcultured them a few times. Nevertheless, there are rumours that there are soil enrichment cultures around, and there's a possibility. On the tree that the Krenak-Hale 16S tree, there was one group which I said was root associated, plant root associated, and There's somebody in the, I think in Canada, who says he has an isolate of a pure culture isolate of that organism, which seems to grow quite quickly and form colonies on plates and so on, but it's not yet published, and that we don't know if it has amyloid. Well, that's interesting because it suggests a different mechanism, and in a way, well, it depends when, how the two groups evolved and when they evolved and so on, and how much gene transfer, horizontal gene transfer there was. But in a way, it'd be surprising if they did it exactly the same as bacteria. Reading the SEN-RKM symbiosin paper, the implication is that there's another mechanism, that there are other cytochromes which can carry out that step in the pathway. So it may just be different.